Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals. All these things.
You're listening to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, a critical examination of the world of pseudo-archaeology and the misrepresentation of archaeology in the world today. Each episode, we focus the lens of archaeology on a topic and discuss reality versus fantasy. We've covered everything from ancient aliens to crystal skulls, from DNA to modern fakes. Join us for our discussion this week and get ready to think critically. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast. I am your host, Sarah Head, and I'm joined today with my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. How's it going, guys?
Going as well as can be expected, Sarah.
I mean, aside from the giant hail.
And... Yeah, giant hail. And I know we're going to be talking to Dave today about pop culture. And here's my old man, curmudgeonly pop culture reference. Well, just within the last couple of days, Margot Kidder died. And it's very sad. She was a wonderful actress, a troubled soul. And yeah, she was in the reboot of Superman, the movie with, who was it, Steve?
Christopher Reeve.
So anyway, but I'm seeing a lot of stuff online, on the internet, on Twitter saying, you know, Margot Kidder, she was the Lois Lane. She defined Lois Lane. I'm sorry, the actresses who defined Lois Lane, who were Lois Lane, are Phyllis Coates and Noelle Neal from The Adventures of Superman 1952 to 1958. And you know, they deserve some mention too in the whole the Lois Lane genealogy.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because I have seen some of that, and they were much stronger, grittier Lois Lanes.
Phyllis Coates, the first one. Yeah, no, she was a tough as nails reporter, and she didn't take shit from Perry White or Clark Kent or Jimmy Olsen. The Noelle Neal character was much, much softer. But that, you know, there's a long history of women playing that character, and Margot Kidder was fantastic, but, you know, there are other people who were part of that universe.
See, when you mentioned Hale, the first thing I thought of was around the time of that Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder film, the Flash Gordon film with fiery Hale, with Clytus. This bores me. That apparently Ming the Merciless was attacking Connecticut. So
it could have been, maybe so. But and did you ever see the movie Flesh Gordon?
No.
I actually saw.
Nope.
And a drive-in, by the way.
I actually haven't seen it, but also nope.
Oh, Lord. So as Ken mentioned, we do have a special guest here today. We have...
So David,
yes.
You're here.
Hello.
Well, there's Jeb Card. Don't forget Jeb is here.
Oh, yeah. Things are happening, apparently. Flash Gordon, that happened.
David is our guest today. David Anderson, who has been on our show before, but he is returning with us today. And the reason we're having David on is because we are starting a theme arc, because I like the way this sounds. And David, you're going to be discussing the topics of pop culture and the intersection with archaeology and pseudo-archaeology with us.
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that I've been trying to develop and work on in my own line here is that, you know, archaeology shows up in a whole bunch of different places in our pop culture world, and that helps shape and mold what the average person thinks of when they think of archaeology.
So can you expand on that idea a little bit?
Sure. You know, and I've had plenty of people, well, let's start with the obvious. You've probably discussed this on the show before, but I tell them I'm an archaeologist who works in Mexico. I study the ancient Maya. And, you know, the first thing that comes out of their mouth is always, hey, Indiana Jones.
Right. Yeah,
sure. And, you know, it's if you ask somebody, if you probe somebody, they know that Indiana Jones isn't real. Most of them know. But the thing is, that's still what first comes to mind. And so I think that's what I want to focus on here is how that regular presence, that first, if it's the first thing that pops into your mind, when I say I do archaeological work on the Maya, then of course it colors and influences how you're going to interpret and understand that archaeological research.
I will say regarding Indiana Jones, I recently went to the Dumbarton Oaks Museum in Washington, D.C. when I was there for the Cypher American Archaeology meetings, and they have that original fake of the Tlazoteotl, the Aztec figurine that's not actually before the 19th century, that is the model for the golden idol. in the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark in that Chachapoya temple, whatever it's supposed to be. And I, when I went, there were a bunch of high school age, like prep school age kids there. They were clearly not connecting that pop culturally, which made me feel very sad and old.
As in they were thinking that that was the real statue, even though it's a real fake, never was real statue?
I think, and that they've never seen that movie.
Yes. Oh, and Indiana Jones is pretty old at this point. But
they probably know the character, but they've probably not watched the films, which I think speaks to the larger how pop culture works, how it puts ideas in our minds, even if we don't know where they come from.
Yeah, we.
Oh, sure.
We kind of discussed that on Twitter one time about, I don't even know, there was somebody who was like, I don't even know who Indiana Jones is, but I know that archaeologists wear fedoras. And it's like, well,
yeah.
That came from somewhere.
But look, you know, if I have a classroom of 90 kids and I ask them, how many of you have heard of ancient astronauts or ancient aliens? They all have. And if I say, how many of you know the name Eric von Däniken? And not a hand goes up.
That's true. Uh-huh.
So it's sort of
okay with that.
Yeah, well, no, I'm saying, but the notion so permeates the culture that you don't even cite the person anymore. It's this idea that exists outside of the context of any individual scholar or writer or popularizer.
Well, and that's the power behind a fact-fiction reversal. When you have these things in fiction, they then reverse and become fact and start to, or fact, scare quotes, and then move back and forth till you don't know where these things come from, so they're true.
Right. Yeah.
So, David, how are you going about this project? Because it is an academic project. You are working on it as a serious archaeologist would work on any project. So how are you collecting data? What are you looking at? What was the ideal, I don't know, artifact that you're wanting to study in this situation?
Yeah. To a certain extent, one of the things I'm interested in is simply the chronological legacy. You know, when do these things show up and where do they show up? And we see certainly there's lots of ancient alien references in comic books that come out before von Däniken. And of course, your listeners know that von Däniken's not the originator of the ancient alien idea, but he's certainly the greatest popularizer of it. And it's really interesting then to see, though, these ideas sort of walk back and forth. They show up in fiction, they show up in quote-unquote factual sources, and then they walk back and forth over and over again. And I think that sort of adds to this mystery element. So one of the things I'm very interested in is chronology. One of the things that, as I think, you know, brought Sarah's attention to this is that I'm interested in the imagery of it, too. And so I've been trying to collect different cover shots from Pulp Fiction books, from comic books, and I've been sharing those on my Twitter. But that aesthetic value is absolutely what draws a lot of people in. And the romance, the so-called romance that built Indiana Jones, but that comes, you know, long before Indiana Jones comes around, is part of what sells people on this notion that archaeology is adventure or, you know, exploration rather than scientific research. And so I'm trying to look at how these themes develop, where they show up, and who's playing with them and who's not. You know, I've got some great overlaps between H.R. Haggard and the City of Z with Percy Fawcett and whatnot. And they keep walking back and forth across this line of fact and fiction, and ultimately everyone becomes confused.
So would you say that the fiction kind of primes the pump? So people are out there going, oh, that's really interesting. And then somebody 5 years later or 10 years later says that presents this as real. And they're already kind of prepared to believe it because, well, I've heard about this before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's not necessarily the intention of the producer of the fiction. But maybe it is. And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. We can go
back. So like Edward Bulwer Lytton, where he's doing all these sort of things with the coming race that get incited by Blavatsky, but he's clearly inspired by sort of proto-theosophy.
Mm-hmm. And I really feel like we should be defining who these people are because I am not as old as you, so I don't know.
These people were dead a century before we're alive, so it's not just us being old. Though we're old. I mean, I'm not denying that.
What? I can't. Could you speak up? Youngsters don't.
Edward Bulwer Lytton is, you probably best know him as It Was a Dark and Stormy Night, but he wrote the book called The Coming Race, which is basically the first lost world story about like a hollow earth and like a secret race which harnesses special powers. I mean, people have argued this is the beginning of the concept of the superhero and psychic abilities. And it was cited by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the primary prophet of theosophy, which is basically the origins of the New Age.
And we have things like, you know, the Shaver stories, which I think, Jeb, you probably are better to describe than I, but they, you know, are sort of the origins in some ways of the modern UFO movement. And yet they're showing up, they're being published in amazing stories. They're being published in a fiction magazine, although allegedly as truth or fact.
Mm-hmm. So now, David, have you heard, I have on occasion heard this explanation that, well, these things are presented first as fiction, and it's all the government is behind this to kind of soften people up so that when the truth is revealed, they won't freak out because it's something they've already been familiarized with. So that somehow, I mean, I've literally had a person say that, you know, the Star Wars, that whole story, I think there's more truth to that than most people believe, in that it's part of a government plan so that when aliens land on Earth and they're part of some global federation, we'll be ready for it.
Yeah, and those claims have been made for a lot of folks. I mean, we've talked before, all of us, about H.P. Lovecraft and the role of people presuming that Lovecraft was trying to get the word out about something true by hiding all of this occult claims as fictional stories. And it's fascinating to me because it really does blur. And I love that I keep using the words truth and fiction because I love the writings of Charles Fort, as crazy and as insane as he clearly was.
Do you really like reading? Because his books are a slog.
Oh, I they are a slog. And I really liked, you know, get a good drink in hand, and I have no
objection. Continue.
If you read Charles Fort, you must read it out loud. You cannot just
like
sit
Shakespeare.
There. It is Shakespeare. It is a rant. It's this man going crazy and screaming at the page.
Interesting.
And he really, you know, Fort suffered from this problem where he believed everything that he read was true. This is my interpretation of Fort's writing. For those of you who do not know, Charles Fort is one of the foundational authors sort of the modern paranormal.
You've ever seen like a conspiracy theorist who has newspaper clippings attached to the wall? That's basically where that starts with Charles Fort.
Yeah. His name has become like an adjective, right?
Fortean.
A Fortean. This is a Fortean event or whatever, yeah. Right?
So here's something really interesting that I want to catch before we get any further. Like we were discussing earlier about how, you know, we have this image of the archaeologist and a lot of people don't know where it comes from anymore, which is, you know, spawned from Indiana Jones. I want to throw our name in there for some reason. It's interesting that you guys bring up Charles Fort, because until like everybody started going into it, I'm sure many people didn't know who Charles Fort is, but we've all seen the image of the crazy man with the newspaper clippings and the string and the photos. And like, we understand that that person is a conspiracy theorist, but you have all just said that that is based off of an actual person.
To some degree.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously it's been exaggerated because it's fiction, but it's a visual tell for anyone watching television or reading a book or looking at a comic. Oh, okay. I know what this character is now because of these visual tells, to the point where we think that that's what they do. I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
No, in the case of Charles Fort, there's not a lot of fictionalization going on here. As I understand it from his biography, he, you know, came into some money and no longer had to work for a living. And he sort of spent the rest of his life going into libraries and museums and just reading archives.
Which is also the best way of life imaginable.
Yes. And he read newspaper after newspaper after newspaper. And anytime he came across anything anomalous, let's say, he would cut, you know, not literally cut it out since he was at a library and museums, but he would write it down. He would copy it down and add it to his file of anomalous or weird stuff.
Also, I'm just going to put it out there. His first book is literally called The Book of the Damned. He had style.
All right.
And I make my students read parts of it. And he thinks, this is particularly interesting in the modern era of fake news, Fort believed everything he read in the newspaper must have really happened. He had no real filter, so anything he ever read, it must have happened. You know, and near the beginning, I think it's chapter 3 or 4 or 5 of Book of the Damned, he starts talking about the fall of red rain and black rain and yellow rain. Yeah. And if you read between the lines, and you have to read very carefully, he argues that this is sort of blood and bile and the burned remains of another planet, and the planet Earth Earth has floated through another planet, and so we're getting this red, yellow, and black rain. And he rejects any scientific explanations that the red rain might be dust from the Sahara, something very well established by our friends in geology. My particular favorite, though, is there's a story about yellow rain in there where he talks about a sailor on a boat who's on watch in the middle of the night, who all of a sudden has this dump of yellow rain fall upon him that smells like urine. And it's yellow rain. And it, therefore, this really, you know, happened. Yellow rain fell from the sky. And I'm sitting there reading the book. It's like, have you never heard of anyone dumping a chamber pot on somebody's head when they were mad? Like, you know,
or a pelican.
Or pelican. Yeah. And it's like, he never questioned. Everything that he read must have really happened. And if it all really happened, then the world doesn't make sense as we understand it.
Yeah. Well, and so, his other thing was like that science won't look at these. The science ignores these. And I would say, well, yeah.
I appreciate that. I was going to say, I appreciate your use of the term filter. He had no filter. In the book Forbidden Archaeology, which is a very bizarre book, Cremo and Thompson, which essentially, again, believes anything related to great antiquity for
Uparts, species, out of place
artifacts.
That is one of my absolute favorite words, by the way.
But the term that they use repeatedly in the book is that we professionals are afflicted by a knowledge filter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a
bad thing. And that's a bad thing. A bad thing. So that, in other words, to actually think about claims that are being made and to assess,
to know something about what you're talking about.
That's a bad thing. That is a bad thing. You should, and that's why we don't accept. We reject or ignore all of this important information because it never gets through our knowledge filter.
If I didn't go to school, I would be a privileged investigator, constantly going around and finding pelican urine.
Well, this is what I love. I mean, about reading the Book of the Damned is because that lack of filter. You can watch Fort lose his mind by reading this book. Because he doesn't know how to deal with it, because it's all too much, and it obviously can't all be happening at the same time. And he ultimately writes, I think the Book of the Damned is a brilliant critique. Is a brilliant postmodern critique of science written by a person who has been driven mad.
I've heard it argued it's the first postmodern critique of science.
Yeah, because he gets very in-depth about how, in essence, science classifies things and how those classification systems are arbitrary, which is true, and therefore science is totally bunk as far as he is concerned as a result of that. And it's this one of these things I walk back and forth with my students when we talk about this in the classroom. Like, this is very, very true. The classification of color is arbitrary. Light is a spectrum. Where we draw a line between orange and yellow is 100% arbitrary. But we desperately need those arbitrary boundaries, or we can never have a conversation about anything. And that's what happens. Fort can no longer talk even to himself because he has thrown the baby out with the bathwater, basically.
It seems like a reaction to how complicated the modern, and I'm using modern with a big M, world is, where science replaces previous forms of authority, but science also on its face says, this is constructed. We constructed this. We're open about that, rather than saying, quite literally, this is the word of God.
It was presented to us, right?
Yeah, and I ultimately, it feels like it is a rebellion against the unsure nature that is honest inquiry.
I think it's interesting that we can trace this back to one individual so clearly as this. I mean, like, the Fortean Times is a well-known.
Yep, I'm a subscriber now.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like, it's the concept of Fortean is pretty well known amongst the pseudo-archaeologists and those of us who study them. But the way, actually, I feel kind of sad because of the way that David's describing this book. I mean, yes, it's wonderful that it's a critique. But the thought that you're, like, reading this man going insane is kind of terrifying. Uh-huh. And very sad that, like, he's losing his mind reading all this stuff and trying to make these connections and then rejecting science. And I mean, like, it's kind of the only thing we've got right now, you know?
The one thing I would add to that, just to be clear, people that generally use the word Fortean now, while not all of them are British, a lot of them are. And the general flavor you get from people, including, I would say, the Fortean Times, are people that will listen to science and that actually are often quite happy to investigate what is called psychosocial hypothesis, mm-hmm. which is basically what we would call, you know, anthropology, or sociology or psychology, that these things are human. They may well be open to parapsychological, or often parapsychological, or other mystical aspects, but they're often very okay with looking at it legitimately. So we're bagging on Charles Fort himself. I would actually say, if you're looking at these, somebody who calls himself a Fortean, it's not a guarantee, but it's often going to be a lot closer to some of the stuff we do on this show than
"I went to the woods and I saw the Bigfoot. You ain't going to tell me it ain't real."
That's a more American and a more little more to the fundamentals perspective than people use the word Fortean for themselves now. That may not be for Charles Fort, but that's how that's developed.
When I was a kid, I had a book of a series of anomalous events in history, but that then presented rational material explanations. So, for example, frogs fall from the sky on a village 14. In France. But then they say, well, you know, what couldn't happen is a waterspout went over a pond that had a lot of tadpoles in it. They got sucked up in the waterspout and they became adult frogs in the air and then fell to the ground.
That's science.
Well, but at least that, in other words, there was an attempt to say this isn't supernatural, that there is a natural explanation for it. Or, well, you know, the year without a summer, which turns out to be, well, that may have been a volcanic eruption that blocked out the sun on so much of the world. And so you could skate on Hudson River in the middle of June. It was still frozen.
Well, let's go to break real quick. And when we come back, David, let's talk some more about your when the day is spent.
Funny beady blokes you will see.
We hope you're enjoying this episode. Please be sure to check out the show notes at www.archiefantasies.com for further information about our hosts, guests, and topics in this episode. This podcast is listener supported, and we appreciate every donation, either in the time it takes you to rate and share this episode, or monetarily on Patreon and Ko-fi. You can connect with us on the blog, by email, or on Twitter, thanks to all of our supporters. And let's get back to the show.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast. We are still speaking with David Anderson about the intersection of pop culture and archaeology and pseudo-archaeology. And Dave, you have a really cool story about how you first became aware of what an archaeologist is.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where I think part of this fiction informs our understanding of the world. And I remember very well when I was young, I was obsessed with something we know of today as the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And for those of you, I'm going to put on my total nerd hat here, because
the books or the movies?
Oh, good God, no. Nerd hat, Sarah. Before the books, there was the radio show.
The BBC radio.
Yes.
The radio
show. And I don't know how, but somehow or another, I ended up with tapes of this radio show that I listened to over and over again. And the first several episodes of the radio show turned into the books and so on, but they eventually diverged. And some of the later episodes of the radio show involved a character known as Lynn Tilla, who was one of, well, let's see.
Oh, I was going to say, because I didn't remember an archaeologist. I haven't read them in a long time, but I don't remember an archaeologist. Okay, that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah, she never makes it into the books, but she is an archaeologist, and she's actually a clone, and there's three of her clones in the story, but then there are like millions of her clones in the universe, which is a whole, you know, part of the joke. They're trying to figure out how to deal with the Lintilla clones.
Little Duncan, Idaho there.
Yes. This is, though, where I learned what an archaeologist was. And as much as it's actually pop culture and all that, it was actually somewhat reasonable. Arthur Dent, our wonderful hero of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, meets Lintilla on a planet where there is a 15-mile-high statue of Arthur Dent, actually. This is when you don't panic when you run into something unexpected in the universe. And the planet has been taken over by a troop of limping soldiers, and he is running away from the soldiers, and Lintilla rescues him and squirrels him away in her trench, where she and her clones are excavating. And they are on this planet excavating as archaeologists to try and solve the mystery of the limping soldiers. And the whole thing turns into sort of a critique of capitalism, really, because it turns out that the soldiers limp because they're wearing bad shoes, and they wear bad shoes because they're employed by the Dolman Sachs Corporation, who has taken over the planet. And they had to take over the planet.
I wonder who the Dolman Sachs people stopped are.
Buying their shoes, and they had
Dolman, D-O-L-M-E-N.
I'd have to look it up. But it's Dolman Sachs, I think, is how they pronounced it, at least back in the day. And so it's, but you know, they were there and they were excavating and they found the layer. That was entirely the stratigraphic layer. It was entirely made up of shoes, which was when the planet was taken over by the shoe company.
It's like that Atari ET dump site in New Mexico.
Yes, exactly.
That's funny. So no, it's great though, because Hitchhiker's Guide, beautiful series of books. If you haven't read them, go read them, because you should.
Oh no, listen to the Radio Pluto.
Well, yeah, and definitely.
Yeah, if you don't read the books, you don't get that character, because I never heard of that.
I do kind of wonder if she wasn't a template for the River Song character that came along later in the Doctor Who series.
They also did one in, I've never read these, but I've looked it up, in the Star Wars Expanded Universe, maybe in comics and also novels. Vader finds like someone who helps him find stuff, and she's clearly sort of like a Lara Croft sort of clone, a little, not literally, but she's an archaeologist. Like they call her that, and she finds like ancient weapon systems and whatnot, and he actually respects her and is like, I'm gonna kill you someday, but like apparently that never happens.
Yeah, that's the Dr. Aphra series. At least that's the newest version of. If I'm not sure the history of this character, but the Dr. Aphra series that's being published now in comics.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, yeah. No, so but there's a long history of this. So there's always an archaeologist lurking around somewhere.
So oh, you keep talking about this whole concept of like fiction informing reality and walking back and forth. So kind of tie us into this. Explain this more to us and flesh it out a little bit more.
Sure. I think there's several things that we haven't talked about yet that deserve being talked about. And one of them, we can sort of run from the recent City of Z, Lost City claims back to the novelist H.R. Haggard, who is often sort of looked at as a root figure in the pulp fiction genre.
Creates the adventure romance.
Yes, adventure romance, sort of lost city narratives or lost civilization narratives. And I am no literary historian, and so I'm sure you have some literary folks who listen and perhaps can correct us or inform us on some of the things that I'm just starting to understand and learn. Yes, but some of the... Several of Haggard's stories, starting with King Solomon's Mines and She and Aisha, basically involve his hero, Allan Quatermain, exploring into the heart of Africa and often interacting with ancient monuments or lost civilizations or lost cities, and very much sets the pattern for how archaeology, ruins, explorers, and whatnot all interact with one another in that fictional sense.
Which I think it's worth pointing out, the first one, King Solomon's Mines, is clearly at least somewhat inspired by the European discovery of Great Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Like that's an obvious... So it's constantly flipping back and forth, and I think it often starts in the fact world, then goes to the fiction world, where it gets a narrative, and then goes back into the air quotes... fact world.
That's my understanding in particular. Haggard acknowledged that this is something that, he was inspired by his fellow British explorers in that day in the 19th century.
And therefore the line between fact and fiction becomes increasingly blurred until it becomes non-existent.
Yes. And it becomes, and so one of the stories that I've become interested in is this Lost City of Z story, of course. And the Lost City of Z is a claim by a later British explorer in the early 20th century, Percy Fawcett, claimed that in the heart of the Amazon there was a city. And they, of course, made a movie out of it recently. And
How's the movie?
The movie, it's one of the movies that I feel like it best captures the essence of a story. Well, getting most of the facts wrong. Yeah. I mean, in any movie, it massages the facts. You've only got an hour and a half. I get it. You're talking about most of Percy Fawcett's life, so they compress his multiple journeys into just one or two. I think one of the things that the movie really highlighted for me is how much of a jerk Fawcett must have been. Because for the movie to make sense, they give him friends who go on his expeditions with him. But in real life, each expedition, he had to take somebody new because the person went on the last expedition didn't want to go with him anymore.
And at least some, like his son. Now, Fawcett, I think this is important to note. So we talked about the 1800s with the people that are inspiring H. Rider Haggard, and they were like archaeologists and they worked in museums. By the time of Fawcett, he is associated with the Royal Society, and he is actually being given like tasks to map out borders in South America, correct?
Yes, that's how he gets his start. You know, he actually goes to the Royal Society's School of Exploration, or he's, you know, this is late colonial era when you can go to explorer's school.
But he's late. So he's beginning to get to that point where you've got like legitimate people in the profession who are not doing that, but he'll still do it. By the time of like in the 30s, Mitchell Hedges in the 20s and 30s, they're having to find like people that are like press hounds who have no real training outside the academia to still fill museums because professionals won't do it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, you know, Fawcett capitalizes because from the Western worldview at that point, the Amazon and the Himalayas are basically the two regions left that the Western world, you know, legitimately are, you know, sort of blank spots on the map. And so Fawcett has this giant blank spot on South America, and he becomes convinced that there's something in the middle. Well, now, if you watch the movie, they basically say, oh, Fawcett found some pottery sherds and thought, oh, there must have been a city here. And in reality, the pottery sherds barely even register in Fawcett sightings. He doesn't really even engage with that. He's interested in these stories of ruins that he has never seen, but everyone keeps telling him are out there somewhere.
It sounds a lot like the Mosquitia and the city of the lost monkey god.
Well, right,
the thing that, you know, has gotten, well, they definitely don't touch on in the movie and got me, you know, kicked off of I was trying to get on a documentary retracing Fawcett's steps, and they didn't like it after I pointed it out to them. For Fawcett, it was very explicitly not just stories of ruins, but it was stories of white Indians. And Fawcett said explicitly only the white Indians could have built large cities, not the other type of natives that lived in the continent. So there's some profound Western racism going on here, too. But so Fawcett hears stories of ruins. He hears stories of white Indians. But he doesn't care about pottery sherds. In his hands, according to Fawcett, he has this weird black idol. And it's got these weird carvings on it, and it has sort of electrical properties. If someone touches it, you feel a slight charge. And he actually takes this idol. Well, he takes it two places. He takes it to a psychic who gives a psychical reading on it. And in essence, the psychic gives him a story about how this idol originated in Atlantis and was carried out of Atlantis during the destruction of the city.
This sounds a lot like the stuff that then on the Crystal Skulls.
It's always Atlantis.
Now, we're going back and forth and back and forth between truth and fiction here. Fawcett also takes the idol to the British Museum. And according to Fawcett, someone at the British Museum told him it's not a fake. Of course, if you show up at the British Museum with an object and tell people it's from Atlantis, they probably, you know, didn't usher him into the director's office.
does this object exist in a known place today?
Not that I don't know where it is.
There any photo of it?
There's a drawing of it in
a drawing.
Jeff, you are way hopeful about this.
Yeah. Well, and here's the rub, and here where we come back to Haggard, is that he got this object allegedly from Haggard.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Now, and this the question, you know, is that story, did he actually get it from Haggard? We don't know. Did Haggard think it was real? Did Haggard give it to him as a joke? I don't know. You know, it just, or did Haggard...
Did Haggard even give it to him?
Or did Haggard even give it to him? We don't really know, but it ties back into someone who is writing adventure stories about people discovering lost cities and jungles. It just keeps, and you know, we can go the opposite direction too, because Arthur Conan Doyle is inspired by Fawcett to write the Lost World series.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we just keep going back and forth between actual explorers who go out into the jungles looking for things and fiction writers who write glorious stories about people going into the jungles looking for things.
See, now I need to find this damn idol.
If you go to, I believe you said you were going to England sometime, Jeb.
That's I am.
Get me that idol.
All right, I'll work on it.
Don't just find it. Bring it back.
It's not like I found bits of a lost continent before or anything.
Well, but... Jeff, that idol belongs in a museum.
Well, they are in my museum.
If it is.
Oh, yes. Oh, wow.
So this is one of those things where I think your average, you know, the people who don't obsess about this stuff like we do, of course they're confused about any of this stuff or what's real and what's not. Could there be a city in the Amazon? Could there be a city in the heart of Africa? Could the archaeologists be covering it up? Why not? They've heard about this stuff from so many different places that maybe it's actually true.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there are so many examples of stuff like this. It immediately comes to mind, you know, the story of the Mary Celeste, which is one of the boats that supposedly disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle. And when you trace it back, in fact, Arthur Conan Doyle wrote a story about a boat called the Marie Celeste, and it was printed in a popular magazine. And that when you look at the bullshit stories that are told in books, credulous books about the Bermuda Triangle, they lift facts from what was clearly and explicitly a fictional account and just incorporated into the real story of the disappearance of this boat, actually nowhere near the Bermuda Triangle.
Well, yeah. Conan Doyle's time is kind of interesting to me, though, because he had the problem of people thinking his most famous character, Sherlock Holmes, was a real person. And I mean, that we're talking about like what, the mid to late Victorian era?
Like 19th, early 20th century. So the end of the Victorian and the early Edwardian.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but I mean, it's hell, like, I've been to 221B.
Right, exactly. Doesn't,
which itself is fake. Is
exactly,
fake anyway.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. But that's the thing. Like, my point is that, like, back when Conan Doyle was alive and writing, information was hard to come by. You know, it was very easy to get misinformation and pass it around. And
well,
we talked about
well, not
all
only
the
that, people were purposely masking that. There's There's the book As If by Siller that looks at the Sherlockians and the Lovecraftians and the Tolkien people. There was a great game where people would purposely sort of imagine a world, you know, they lived in a world where Holmes was real and that Doyle was just his literary agent.
Right.
And they really figured out like ways to make this happen because Weber and Disenchantment and yeah.
Well, and but today, I mean, back then, I guess what I'm saying is back then it can be forgiven. This meant this
was
beliefs.
Knowing.
But
this
then
was knowing.
Some of it was. Yeah. But then you get to today and it's like you would think, here being the key term, you would think that in an era where we can Google damn near anything, you would think that it would be easy for us to pick out between fact and fiction and to understand where
it's the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the opposite.
Exactly.
It's exactly the opposite.
We have too much information now, and it's difficult for people to discern between a factual source of information and a source of information that, like David is suggesting, is pulling information based off of, unknowingly pulling information maybe even from sources that are fiction.
Well, it's not just that there's too much information, that there is both an accidental and a purposeful erosion of credibility in authorities and in quote unquote gatekeepers. The all of this information, and I'm putting it that it is information, whether it's true or not, is out there, is a accidental erosion of people actually know what the hell they're talking about. And then there's also purposeful. I was reading a post by Jason Colavito this morning, tracking back the idea that there are radioactive skeletons at Mohenjo-Daro, which has been used by ancient aliens people to turn into the idea that there were nuclear exchanges in the past. This ultimately goes back to Sputnik, a propaganda organ for the Soviet Union, which routinely ran ancient alien stuff, with what appears to be the agenda of weakening intellectual authority institutions in the West. Like,
this
is not new.
This is why I think it's so important to talk about these things, why I want to talk to you guys, why I know not everyone's a fan in this room, but why I speak out on Twitter. Like, if you can't discern what's real or not real anymore,
exactly,
we're in deep trouble. And so I think it's so important.
I think we're in deep trouble.
This. Yeah.
This boat has left the dock.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about that a little bit at the SAAs, and David was part of the panel that Jeb and Ken sat on about combating pseudo-archaeology, but that was the thing we were talking about. This boat has sailed, and now, I mean, it's out there. What do we do to mitigate the damage of it? And I think David's doing a really great job on Twitter, you know, bringing up when he finds them, the really cool pop culture, the noir book covers and some of the really old comic book covers that you find.
Right, yeah.
And pointing
you've been pulling a lot from the comics, David. You've had, like, you know, Superman looting Egyptian tombs and all this stuff.
Superman for a while.
Superman is a jerk.
Well, remember, there used to be this site called, and this is, you know, I know we occasionally get comments, but it's not my name, Super Dickery, because there was this. So apparently the two things that would sell a cover for a comic book in the 1950s and 60s was A, having one of your characters do something, like say or do something insane that would clearly end those characters, and of course it gets fixed, like sort of a cliffhanger, or B, putting a gorilla in. Like, apparently that was a thing. Like, there was actual marketing where if you put a gorilla in, people would buy more copies. So that's why there's all these, like, gorilla heroes and villains, especially in DC at that time, DC Comics. But you've been working on a lot of these sort of, you know, images and uses of archaeology in, like, comics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's some of that, kind of like the gorilla. There are a lot of covers out there of different superheroes in front of the pyramids or the Sphinx or the statues of Easter Island. There's a lot of Easter Island statues. There was in, you know, late 60s, there were a lot of comic book covers featuring the Moai.
I think they're also kind of easy to draw. Like, I almost just draw one. I think that's part of it.
Yeah. And I think fair bit of that is, you know, in essence, what you're saying with the gorilla. It's like, hey, there's something cool, interesting, weird, people kind of recognize, put it on the cover. Who cares what the story's about? Just put that image on the cover and the rest will follow. And so there's a lot of that. And that's, I think that stuff's interesting from two perspectives, that, you know, it's using archaeology as a lure and just drawing people in. And so it's, you know, the interest in archaeology, the interest in the ancient world is there, however, and you can draw people in. Second thing I wanted to say, that it's too perfect. There's a psychology study, and I'm afraid I would have to look up the authors of this, but that they it's a study of visual perception, and they ask people to pass a basketball back and forth. Some people are wearing white shirts, some people are in black shirts, and you, the viewer, are supposed to watch and count how many times the person's
the
wearing
basketball is passed.
The basketball, and in the middle of the video, a gorilla walks through the room.
To be fair, a person in a gorilla suit. Also known as the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film, but I don't
know. And half the people, I believe it's approximately half the people who were tested on this video, did not notice the gorilla because they were so interested in counting the number of
basketballs. One of the problems of being versed in skeptical stuff, I can never experience that because I heard about it before I saw it.
Well, but it's great because this is the thing with archaeology as a lure. People are being drawn in and they're not necessarily paying attention to what's going on in the background. And I think this is the mysticization of archaeology is laid out.
Well, I think there's another fascinating piece. You're talking about things primarily from the 50s and 60s for the most part.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. So Western archaeologists were not working a great deal in Egypt at that time. There was some because of the cooperation with the Aswan and Nasser government. And, you know, you can think of all the things there. But there was not as much archaeology. A lot of it feels like nostalgia for empire. I know. I just was listening to a very fantastic discussion on a podcast about spy literature and how Ian Fleming had no interest in the Cold War. His James Bond stories were basically old style imperial stories about the awesomeness of the British Empire, but set in his modern day. And a lot of these stories have a very nostalgic, like, this is all about old empire. And I think a lot of the archaeology stuff is basically echoes of Tut 30 years on.
That's interesting.
And not just Tut.
That's interesting. Well, let's go to break real quick. And when we come back, maybe we can flesh that out a little bit more and let David get to some of the other points he wanted to hit us with.
Going to the pub when the day is spent. Funny beady blokes.
We hope you're enjoying this episode. Please be sure to check out the show notes at www.archiefantasies.com for further information about our hosts, guests, and topics in this episode. This podcast is listener supported, and we appreciate every donation, either in the time it takes you to rate and share this episode, or monetarily on Patreon and Ko-fi. You can connect with us on the blog, by email, or on Twitter. Thanks to all of our supporters, and let's get back to the show.
Hey, everyone. everyone, and we are back, and we are still speaking with David Anderson. And David, you were hitting some points right before we went to break that you'd like to pick up with.
Yeah, so I mean, we were saying in comic books there are sort of these appearances of the pyramids and other such things because they're popular, they're well known. But then there's another layer of what we see, particularly among Marvel comics, where we see repeated references to what we would call today ancient aliens. And this is, I think, really sort of preparing the path. Now, that's not saying it's deliberate, but this is what has prepared the path for some wide-scale belief in ancient aliens today. And this goes way, way back. There's some stuff in the 50s where we have characters seeing pyramids being built by aliens. Oh, I'm forgetting the Rip Van... Oh, it's not Rip Van Winkle. That would be the nice way to do this. Rip Hunter, Time Master.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Has a number from the 1950s, a number of issues that are devoted to aliens coming to the path, the Earth.
Oh, is it like DC's Hawkman is sort of tied into all this, too?
Yeah,
Hawkman. Hawkman is Carter. His cover name is Carter Hall.
Yes.
Which is deliberately referencing Howard Carter. And so Hawkman's one. I haven't gotten myself my hands on the Golden Age comics of this, but when Hawkman's origin was retold in the 90s based on Golden Age material, Hawkman is a reincarnated Egyptian pharaoh. But he's specifically in his dreams that he had about being a pharaoh in ancient Egypt. He dreamed that he was a white pharaoh, a blonde white man who was a pharaoh in ancient
Egypt. That also feels a little Randolph Carter.
Yeah. There's a whole kinds of things here. There's all kinds of layers here. But I think one of the things that really excited me recently is, you know, if we see all the stuff that's going on in the movies with Marvel nowadays, with the Avengers, with
let's talk Guardians Marvel.
The Galaxy, everything else, there's some very explicit ties going on here. So one of the things I stumbled across looking at this, we have the character Ronan the Accuser, who is the bad guy in the first Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, who refuses to do a dance-off.
Yes, refuses to do a dance-off.
Unless you watch the extra film footage, and then there is...
Which I've seen.
Totally
I've seen.
A dance-off. And
oh, yeah, there is.
One of my favorite scenes ever that didn't make it into a movie. But anyway, go on.
So Ronan, turns out, in the Marvel Universe was the first appearance back in the 60s of a Kree. So this standard alien race that is part of the Marvel Universe now.
Like X-Men and other things, too. Yeah.
So Ronan appears in a Fantastic Four issue, issue number 65, and it turns out that he is comes to Earth in this issue due to what happened in issue 64, where the Fantastic Four stumble across a guardian who had been left on Earth by an ancient alien race that had been left there to protect their buildings, protect their architecture. And this is very specifically laid out in this is published in 1967. So this is prior to Anakin's book coming out, although of course Von Daniken didn't invent these ideas,
it's after Morning Editions, for example.
Yeah. Right. So, and this story, not surprisingly, was written by Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
And Jack Kirby, we know, is clearly drawing on this alternative literature. Now, there's some questions. I think there are varying opinions out there of how much he believed or didn't believe. But Kirby clearly is literally reading sort of occult alternative literature.
Yeah.
And
between him and Steve Ditko with Doctor Strange. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so quite literally, I mean, Ronan the Accuser is a Kree who is part of this alien race that came to the Earth in the past and built structures on Earth. That's been in the Marvel Universe since 1967. That's not something new, you know, from the comic books or new from the TV show, you know, the Ancient Aliens TV show or anything. So this is, you know, Kirby comes back to this theme a lot. The best known example of Kirby doing this is his short-lived book, The Eternals, which came out in the 70s, so after Von Daniken's book. But The Eternals quite literally is written as an ancient aliens homage.
Doesn't it start in South America?
Yeah, and there are several images that are clearly based off of things like Pakal's rocket ship and whatnot. Yeah. Jack Kirby, again, you know, I've had people tell me like, oh, but he didn't believe that. He didn't believe any of this stuff.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, so I'm speaking from the perspective of somebody who truly is ignorant of all of these universes you're talking about. Wasn't a big Marvel guy or DC guy. I read Classics Illustrated because I think my parents wanted me to be, you know, better informed about real stuff. But here's the thing. Jeb often talked about the fact that people view ancient Egypt and view antiquity as a mythic time. And so you've got this mythical universe with these mythical characters. Doesn't it make absolutely sense to tie them in to these mythical times when Egyptians were building pyramids and Aztecs were fighting Maya, whatever? So it makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think this is where these issues that I keep bringing up of fact and fiction matter so much, because people know, like, oh yeah, the pyramids are real and there were the Egyptians and there's the Maya. They might be the same time frame. I don't know. And so the more these lines get blurred, I think the harder it is for your average person to distinguish and to understand where the problems lie. And so, and this is where I feel like I'm going to be a Debbie Downer here in some ways too. I love this pop culture, by the way, just to make that clear. I love Marvel. I love these movies. I enjoy watching Indiana Jones despite all the colonial issues. This stuff is fun, and I don't, you know, I'm not want to throw it out because of, but it blurs lines, and it blurs lines in a way that makes it difficult for us to untangle them and to explain to people what the problems with things like the show Ancient Aliens are.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree. It's important that people understand that you can absolutely adore and love something and still be critical of it. Like, I'm very much like you. I love this new Marvel Cinematic Universe that they're coming out with. I've been reading Marvel comics for decades, and it's really great to see this fresh new take on it and the retelling of the stories and all of that. But at the same time, like, there's some problems, and they should be addressed. I think you make a very valid point about, you know, you can love this stuff and still point out the problem. It sounds like it's kind of like a gateway drug almost, you know?
There you go. I think that's a very good reason.
Well, if you become interested in archaeology because you read a comic book or watched a movie, that is, you're interested in archaeology. That's a wonderful thing. I've said, I think perhaps even on your show before, I got interested in archaeology from reading something that is definitely a pseudo-archaeology book. And so clearly, you know,
Fingerprints of the Gods.
Fingerprints of the Gods. And so I came from, I'd say, you know, a much worse place than a Marvel comic book to get interested in archaeology.
Well, either you're going to get interested in archaeology or you're interested in just taking a hell of a lot of DMT. I mean, that's one of the two things that comes out of that.
Well, so. The DMT wasn't there yet, I think, in that
That's
book.
True. Yeah, that's so, fair. Yeah. That's
he
fair.
Was I smoking wait. Pot. He was That yeah. was the green bitch, as he refers to marijuana.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, David, so the question I would have, and this is something that came up. I did an interview where we talked about the Megan Fox show, which you've talked about a lot online. You've been quoted several times about that and some other things. Also, the death of Art Bell recently on the 15 Credibility Street podcast with Sharon Hill and Torkel. Let me pose a question here. So you just said, you know, you can get an archaeology in various ways, but and again, we're waiting for this Megan Fox show to come out because I actually have some interesting thoughts about that, but I don't want to talk about that. I think there's an interesting question that I'm not sure we know the answer to. Do we see these kinds of things? Let's not talk about necessarily what's on like the History Channel or whatnot, but these kinds of very pop cultural approaches to archaeology that are full of colonialism, full of aliens, full of pseudoscience, full of anti-modernity, full of Weber, full of all these sorts of things, enchantment, if you don't know what that means. There's an argument that these things can lead you to science. They can lead you to, at least not necessarily everybody, but, you know, look, I grew up on things like In Search of and At, and I think that's part of my DNA. But I also recently made the argument that if these media products have a particularly conspiratorial angle, that the authorities are always lying, that everything is hidden, that I don't think it actually takes you there. You know, like if the entire point of some show where you're knocking around trying to find various Phoenicians and Celts and other old world, I'll use that term, people in the Americas, and but it's being hidden from you by the big bad Smithsonian. If there's an inherently conspiratorial place there, does that get you to actual interest in science, or is it just like bring you into political conspiracy?
It can, but I don't think that I'm not aware of any hard numbers to suggest how often which result happens. I mean, I can speak from my personal anecdotal experience that, you know, by, as I was saying, read Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, which is very much an anti-authority book.
Yeah, no, that is not necessarily overtly conspiratorial, but that's clearly in its DNA.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it lays out that, quote unquote, mainstream archaeology is hiding things or covering things up or too narrow-minded to see the truth.
Does he argue in that they're narrow-minded, that they're actually covering it up? Because I do think there's a distinction.
I would have to double-check myself, because there is a distinction, you're right, and I'd have to double-check myself of exactly which tact he takes in that particular book.
I don't think I reviewed that book for the American Antiquity, and to the best I recollect, it's mostly that the professional community is ignoring this.
That we're idiots.
Yeah, not that we know the truth, because you know there is that. It's not really a subtle. And I get emails from people having done this show, having done Talking Heads stuff, and I will, you know, I don't know what I couldn't give you the math. But there's the preponderance of them is basically you archaeologists are idiots because you're not considering this. Right. But there certainly is a subset of those reactions to those emails that's, you know more than you're letting on.
Yeah.
What, you know, there's something deeper here and darker. And where the hell they're getting that? But I think Jeb's right. If you're coming at any archaeology from that perspective, if that's your reaction, the more we try to teach, the deeper that conspiracy is. But I don't have numbers either.
Well, and I can say from my personal experience, that's what I took away from that book, from Hancock's book. And it inspired me to take archaeology classes. But my attitude when I took those classes was, I am going to overthrow the man. I am going to learn about this and damn these guys who are, not seeing the reality of what's right in front of their nose. And slowly, as I took more and more classes, it was like, actually, no, there's actually a lot more problems back with that, with Hancock's book, than there is with this field. And I think that's, if we come back to this show that the Travel Channel is running, Myths and Mysteries with Megan Fox, and that she is an executive or some upper-level producer on. My specific beef with this show is that in the press release announcing it, they're advertising the reason that Megan Fox would make a great host is because she is not constrained by the Academy.
Yeah, she doesn't have a reputation to lose. I think she puts it some way. And also her own history has been lied about, so she knows that's how history is.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know what she meant by that. I don't know her personally. I don't know what her background is.
I suspect that involves she like got a foul of like Hollywood things. Let's just leave it there.
Tabloid rumors about whatever.
And there are plenty of real examples of historians and even archaeologists ending up on the wrong side of history, so to speak, and misrepresenting facts.
I do it daily.
Oh, of course. This is, my concern, though, with things like this is that it undermines the idea that archaeologists actually know something, that our statements are based on research and facts and data and observations, and that there's an actual value to that expertise. I mean, love or hate Indiana Jones for a lot of good reasons. He was Dr. Jones. He was a professor. He was respected. He was considered knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. The character, people turned to him because he was an expert on it.
I think it's important that every pop media clone of him, Lara Croft, the guy from the Uncharted or whatever it is, none of them have that element. They're just treasure hunters. And I think that's a very important distinction.
Yeah. And that's certainly, if we look at this anti-authority literature or TV shows, that's my greatest concern, is that as these things propagate, there's more and more statements that, suggest to the general viewer, or the general consumer, that you can show up, those big wigs in the ivory tower, you with your Google engine search and your cable TV subscription know more about Rome or the Amazons or anything else than someone who spent their entire life studying it.
Well, it also negates the last 100 years of professionalization.
Yeah.
It takes us back to the Victorian era, where you can all drink now, where where talking about race is okay, because that's often where this goes. It's talking about race. It's talking about like mysticism isn't okay. It's talking about creationism is okay. It's basically repealing the 20th
but
century.
It also like furthers this idea that like I think Jeb brought this up on his Twitter feed the other day. The whole thing of, oh, it's just harmless fun. It's just entertainment. Nobody really takes it seriously. And it's like,
well, we do live in the era where nothing matters, apparently.
But
nothing matters.
But, I mean, clearly there are people who do take it seriously. I mean, we get emails pretty frequently from people asking that we look at an artifact that they have found, or that we direct them to or give them some kind of professional opinion on something that is clearly
coal slag.
Well,
coal
yeah, that turns out to be a really neat rock, or something that is clearly bought out of a gift shop or things like that. And it's because people, even we're kind of a little guilty of it ourselves. Even people listen to our show, and so they think that since we are archaeologists, we are obviously authorities on everything. And it's like,
Well, I do like to think of myself
true.
That way.
This is true. But
well, you are, Jeb.
We love Jeb, actually. But yeah, but this comes back to that whole concept of, I like to think of it as the everyman myth, where it's like the common man rises up against the evil corporate university and proves everybody wrong with his one artifact that he found in a river somewhere with no provenance on it.
My highly funded pension and salary are now ruined.
I think there's something also to be said that you know, it's pretty easy to make an outrageous claim and show some pretty images in a television show that lasts with, you know, after commercials, 45 minutes. And it's much more difficult to say, well, no, what you need to do is read this 100-page, these two chapters in this book, because this tells you exactly what we know. And the good news is that sometimes that actually happens. I had this email attacking me because I had said, well, no, Egyptians could build pyramids. And what I did was I responded. And I said, listen, what I want you to do is I want you to go to the library and I want you to take out this book called Building in Egypt by Dieter Arnold. Read that and then get back to me. And this guy did. And the theme of his email was, I didn't realize you guys actually knew a lot about this. It's like,
turns out,
you know,
son. What do you think we do with most of our lives?
I mean, make podcasts.
We sit in our ivory towers, we smoke our pipes, and we pontificate without ever going out into the field. I'm sure, I don't know, Jeb, if you've gotten this, but I get people fairly frequently saying, well, you know, if you were out there actually digging, and I said, what the fuck do you think I do? You want to see my clothes when I get back from the field? That's exactly
no
what
to
I
see
do.
Those. Because
no.
Nobody well exactly.
It's the series of small walls syndrome, I think. For you know, there's the conspiratorial angle here. But if you're familiar with Eddie Izzard's joke, where archaeologists are showing him around a site and they're saying, this is where, you know, this person slept, this is where this person did this job. And Eddie Izzard looks at this, looks like a series of small walls to me.
Yeah.
And there's a way in which I think, you know, most archaeology to be presented to the public has to be simplified, because we want to tell a good story. We want to tell the narrative of what we learned about an archaeological site. And so all people see is a series of small walls. And then we concoct this grand narrative. And they don't realize necessarily all of the data, all of the work that went on behind that, that allowed that narrative to be constructed. And this is something, you know, I think in public archaeology, we need to do a better job of showing our work. That, you know, we can't need to present the good, sexy, interesting narrative of what happened at this ancient city. But we have to do a little bit more about sort of lifting the curtain and saying, you know what, there's data behind this interpretation. There's work behind this interpretation.
And the small walls that David's referring to, if you've never been to an archaeological site like this, where you go into a room with a foundation and there are foundations for the walls that have been reconstructed to like 6 inches to a foot above the ground surface to show you the floor plan. And that's fascinating and all. But if you're thinking of archaeology in a mythic sense, which most people do because it straddles the mythic and human experiences of time, you're like, what the hell is this? Like, you know, it's a school the size for ants. You know, it's got to be at least 5 times bigger. And, you know, why is this so small? Why is this so mundane? Why is this so human? This is person with accent who's telling me about people lived here and they like threw their trash away and there are small walls. But when I think of archaeology, I think of these comic books, which are about Moai and pyramids and big images, which is a long-term experience with human conceptions of time that should be far bigger than us. And archaeologists provide an image which is generally actually far smaller.
This is why I think this fiction is so important. If we want to do a good job as archaeologists protecting cultural heritage, we need to talk to the public. And if we're going to talk to the public, we need to understand what they think the past is like.
And at least something of what they want.
Yeah. And if they're not, if they're interested in ancient aliens, if they're interested in Atlantis, it's not because they're dumb. It's because there's a century of popular literature telling them that's what the past is like.
And there are reasons why that was successful.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we're coming up on the end of our episode. And David, I just want to thank you very much for being on. I think we've really started touching on a very interesting topic, at least to me, because I think pop culture is really interesting, especially when you start looking at the intersects of archaeology and now pseudo-archaeology with it. So I'm very glad that you're coming on board to help kind of outline this stuff a little bit more, bring some illumination to it. And maybe people can take away a little bit more than they knew before about these topics and where they came from and why it's not necessarily fact. But I want a moment to have a final thought on the matter, and I want Jeb's final thought, and then I want to hear what you have to say as a wrap up.
Yeah, my final thought just follows up on exactly what we were talking about. There has been more than once personally I've received blowback for saying, you know, one of the jobs of the archaeologist is to be a storyteller. And that's not what we should be doing. We should be doing pure science. We shouldn't be telling stories. And the folks out there really who support archaeology by going to archaeological sites, national monuments and national parks, who go to museums, who go to lectures, who buy books, who consume television shows, they want to hear the stories that we are able to put together. We have to put together better stories than the people spouting bullshit, and those have to be, and we have to explain, here's how we know what happened in the past. It's not revelation, it's hard work.
Jeb?
I'm going to see, because I talk a lot, I'm going to see the floor to David, other than just to say, I'll just ask a question to let him go. Where would you want to go next with all this kind of like digging into pop culture?
I think there are lots of good stories here. And where I would like to go with this is to explore what's the fun pop culture story, and then what's the actual research that inspired or is associated with or tangential to that fun pop culture story. So I think that's the most important thing here. These are fun stories. There are good archaeological stories here. There are good pop culture or fictional stories here, and we can enjoy both of those. Let's take advantage of this idea of walking back and forth between them so we can learn more about both. I think that's ultimately what I would like to do with this project, is to say that, you know, you can enjoy that pop culture, but let's sneak in a little bit of education on the side for the fun.
You're reversing the fact fiction reversal.
Exactly.
I just got whiplash, so yeah. So David, thank you again very much. I completely agree with this whole concept of we need to tell better stories, but we also need to show our work. The thing that came to mind was Ivor Hume and in Small Things Forgotten, which is not written by him.
That's Deets.
Both really good books, very approachable to the public because they tell stories, but they also show their work. And so, guys, thanks very much for being on the show. And
David, be sure to say hey to Megan for me. All right,
to Megan.
When yeah. she calls, I will.
Because you guys are on a first name happens, basis now, right?
Let us know. Well, yeah.
I think I've been blessed by all things Travel Channel for some reason. But honestly, Travel Channel, if you're
wait, you don't want to hang out with Josh Gates?
I will talk with anyone. If you, and this is, you know, trending hashtag ask an archaeologist. If you're going to do a show about the ancient world, talk to us. We actually study it. We'd love to talk to you.
Hang on, David. Do you have Rh negative blood?
I'm actually not sure. Probably.
Because if you do, you're part of the conspiracy. So
Well, I'm part of the conspiracy. That
but
I know.
To show you how powerful the Travel Channel is, David, one day you're going to turn on your TV and you won't even get the Travel Channel on your cable package. It will just be it'll disappear.
Hey, they're voting on net neutrality today, so we don't know.
Lost channels are my next thing, right? We'll hunt,
lost
channels. Oh
my God! What was once the Learning Channel is
Lost Channels hidden series. Yeah. Anyway, guys, thank you very much. And I'm going to go.
All right, thanks a lot, David.
Thanks.
Extrapolating from a single stone the extent of a whole complex and then publishing it as a completely known fact and making sure that everyone...
If you'd like to support the podcast, consider donating to us on Patreon or Ko-fi. Either option helps us out. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on the blog, www.archiefantasies.com, and like and share us wherever you can. You can follow us on Twitter, at ArchieFantasies, or you can reach us by email at ArchieFantasies@gmail.com. That's A-R-C-H-Y, fantasies@gmail.com. Theme music was provided by Archeosuit Productions. This episode was produced and edited by Sarah Head.
We don't do dinosaurs! See? Are you happy? Do you get it now? Do you get it? Honestly.